Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and for giving me the opportunity to speak here about, well, the average Frobenius number. And before I explain what the Frobenius number is and what the problem is behind this number, I would like to mention that what I present here is part of joint works with Iskander Aliyev from Cardiff University and Eike Hinrichs from Universität Jena. So what is a Frobenius number? It is assigned to a positive integral vector in Rn, denoted by A, and I have to, well, I assume that the greatest common divisor of all the coordinates is equal to 1. Such a vector will be also called a primitive lattice vector. And now the Frobenius number, denoted by capital F of A, is the largest integer which cannot be written as a non-negative integral combination of my coordinates. So if I take all inner products of my input vector A with all non-negative integer vectors in Rn, and then I take the largest number which is not in this set. Okay, so this is called the Frobenius number. So here's an example. If A is 3 and 10, then you can look at all inner products of A with non-negative integer vectors. You get this set. And here the largest integer, which is not contained in this set, so which is not representable as a non-negative integer combination of the numbers, is 17, and this is a Frobenius number. Okay? So what has it to do with the geometry? Well, there's a simple explanation. Suppose you have a right-hand side number b, an integer, and you look at the hyperplane ax equals b, and you intersect it with a positive orthon. Then you get a simplex, because a is a positive vector. And so we are interested in lattice point properties of the simplex, so we want to find the maximal right-hand side so that this simplex does not contain an integer point. And this is a Frobenius number. Observe that if you increase the right-hand side b, then you get a dilate of your simplex. So when b is getting larger, the simplex is getting larger and larger. And since the greatest common divisor of a is 1, all these hyperplanes are lattice hyperplanes. So they contain lattice points. Okay? And this means, of course, when your simplex is getting larger and larger and larger, at some point, you will always find an integral point in your simplex. Just think at the integral lattice set n, okay, consisting of points with integral coordinates. Whenever you have a sphere of radius square root n over 2, no matter where you place it, it contains an integer point. So this immediately shows you that this number really exists. Okay, and so what we use here, I mean, we use geometry of numbers, of course, tools from geometry of numbers, and we are interested in so-called lattice point-free simplices. That's the geometry behind it. Now, what is known about this problem? There's a very nice solution, most likely to Sylvester, for the two-dimensional case, and here it is just the product minus the sum. Well, I mean, you can try to prove it. It's a nice solution. In higher dimensions, what about dimension 3 and so on? There we have only algorithmic solutions, and also these solutions are not very efficient because this problem is known to be NP-hard, and now we know all what this means. So we actually can also not hope for a good solution. Now then the next step is you look for bounds. And there is a huge literature about bounds, and here I just want to mention one, and maybe this is the first one which I have found. It is Toucheur from 35, and it is of this type. And then there are many, many, many more bounds by many, many more people. This is a completely incomplete list of contributors to this problem. All of what I want to mention here is that all the known upper bounds are of quadratic order in the input size, so they, with respect to the maximum, say. And it is also known that this is best possible. This was, for instance, pointed out by Erdős and Graham, Schlage, Puchter, and Arnold. Next question is lower bounds. Well, again, there are many, many, many lower bounds. All of them are more or less of this type. That's quite nice, actually. You have here something like, if you think at the two-dimensional solution, then for n equals 2, you precisely get the product minus the sum. And here you have something like the geometric mean, completely, and then you subtract the numbers. And all the known lower bounds differ a little bit by this constant. And here, and I don't want to go into the detail, but I just want to mention, if we assume for the moment that the AIs are more or less of the same size, so this lower bound is somehow maximized, then you get, in order to compare it with the upper bounds, you get something which is of order 1 plus 1 over n minus 1. So in principle, something which is linear. And again, this is best possible. Okay, so we have an x-axis solution, dimension 2. We have upper bounds, which are quadratic. We have lower bounds, which are linear. And then the next natural question is, what can we say about the average? And this was initiated, actually, by Arnold in 1999, and then he studied this problem in a couple of papers. And he conjectured something like that. The typical behavior of the Frobenius number is something like this, or behaves like the lower bound, roughly speaking. So he said, or he conjectures that FA grows like T to the 1 plus 1 over N minus 1 for a typical vector with one norm equals to T. Okay, you take all the vectors with input vectors with one norm equals to T, you take the uniform distribution, and then this was the conjecture. The first result in this, with respect to this conjecture, is due to Bogin and Zinai from 2007, but they proved it with respect to the following vectors. So here, whenever I will write probability in the following, then I mean the uniform distribution with respect to all primitive points of maximum norm at most capital T. So I take the cube sitting in the positive orthon, and I take the uniform distribution with respect to all the primitive points. And they proved that, let me say it in this word, that the Frobenius number, that the probability that the Frobenius number is much larger than the, say, conjectured average behavior is somehow small, in the sense that they showed that here that there is a function epsilon of capital D which does not depend on T, and it tends to zero as capital D approaches infinity. Okay, so this is the result, but in this paper they don't say anything about the expectation. They use continued fraction methods and tools from probability theory, and with completely different methods, namely from geometry of numbers, we could obtain a similar result. So it looks quite similar. The difference is here we can replace this capital T really by the length, so to speak, of the vector, and we can say something about the order of decay. Where here I should explain, this symbol means that I don't care about constants depending on the dimension. Okay, sometimes it's also called Vinogradov symbol. I don't care about that. So we get here a quadratic decay, and this is good enough in order to say something about the expectation. Okay, then you get this result. From this immediate, you get more or less this result, and this tells you, at least with respect to our model, so we take the uniform distribution among the points in this cube, that the Frobenius number does not essentially exceed, well, this bound. Okay, then we learned that there is an even stronger conjecture by Arnold. Namely, he asked in some other papers whether it is possible really to replace this number here really by, let me say, the geometric mean, so the dominating term of the lower bounds which we have. Okay, so this was a conjecture, or this is what he conjectured. Actually, he did it in a stronger form, I must say. He says he has also conjectured about the right constants, and we don't care at the moment here about constants. So this means that if this is true, then in the average, one can say that the Frobenius number is close to its lower bound. Okay. And this conjecture was also supported by a lot of extensive computations. And there's also a recent result by Markloff from 2009, extending former results by Schur, Zinai, and Ustinov in the three-dimensional case, supporting this conjecture. What is proven here is that the Frobenius number has a limit distribution where we normalize the Frobenius number by this product. Okay? And so in this limit distribution, psi of n is a continuous non-increasing function. And in fact, Maklov was also able, by the way, with completely different methods, so actually more with algebraic methods, he considered a certain flow on the space of all lattices and he is studying the dynamics of this flow. He can also describe this limit distribution, which is not so surprising. I don't want to go into the details. It has something to do, of course, with the simplex and the so-called inhomogeneous minimum. But again, he cannot say anything about this function. He just knows that it's a continuous non-decreasing function. So he doesn't know how fast it is maybe decreasing. But if we go to our result, and since we don't care about constants depending only on the dimension, then in our result we can replace the maximum norm, say, by the one norm. It doesn't matter. It's still true. And so if you think that actually would like now to replace the denominator by this product. So we want to prove a similar result for the product in the denominator. Okay, this would be somehow related to this conjecture of Arnold. And then it's clear what you try to do. I mean, all what is missing is something like a reverse geometric arithmetic mean inequality. You can work it out with high probability. So this is what we want to show, actually, that this probability is small. You can write it in this way. And so we want to show that the arithmetic mean, that the probability that the arithmetic mean is much larger than the geometric mean is small. But this, of course, is true. It has to be true. And in the continuous setting, this was, at least to my knowledge, I found it in this paper of Kluskin and Millman. So here you take now you consider this on the sphere equipped with a rotation invariant measure, and they proved this. But we have to know it for primitive lattice points. For all lattice points, it is not a problem. The problem is to handle these primitive lattice points because the GCD is one. And of course, you can say, now I scale them and I look how they are distributed on the sphere. But that's not clear. At least the number theorists don't know any results about the distribution of primitive lattice points scaled to the sphere in dimensions greater or equal 3. But nevertheless, you can just copy the proof somehow. You go to the proof and you replace integration by summation, because summation with respect to lattice points is more or less integration. Okay, you just integrate with respect to primitive lattice points, but the proportion of primitive lattice points to all lattice points is controlled by the zeta function. And basically, we are done. And after we have done this, we realize one can do it more simple. Namely, you just can compute higher moments, and you can apply Markov inequality, and you get a little bit better exponent here. So if you do it directly in the discrete way. Okay, now you have this what you want. I mean that the probability that the arithmetic mean is much larger than the geometric mean is rather small. And now you put all the things together and you get what we wanted, not maybe what you, but what we wanted, namely this probability. Again, we have enough decay, so to speak. This is somehow the game. We have enough decay in order to say something about the expectation. And so you can now control it up, but as I said, we don't care about constants depending on the dimension. Okay, this is the point here. So I don't know. Actually, we have never worked it out. Maybe it's too depressive. to work out the constant. But nevertheless, it tells you with respect to your input vector. Yes, this is the expectation. Okay. Then the next step is, of course, what about generalizations? What now? And I should say, the people in optimization are very much interested in these problems because there it is also known as a knapsack problem. It is a standard problem for testing algorithms. And in particular, they're interested in the case when this one vector is replaced by a matrix. Okay, now we have a generic matrix. I mean, it has to satisfy certain properties. Again, I don't want to go into the details. And we are interested actually now in this polytope. Now we don't have a simplex, unfortunately, anymore. Now in general we have a polytope here, PAB, and we are interested in the right-hand side vector so that this polytope contains an integral point, a lattice point. So in other words, now we are interested in the all right-hand side vectors, which can be written as non-negative integral combination of the cousins. Okay. And here, again, I don't want to go into the details, just let me mention that you can generalize the result, you get similar results, and of course this is not true, because, I mean, to some extent you get similar results, because here the situation is more complicated. For instance, here, for this matrix, the green dots are, so to speak, the right-hand sides which are reachable. So these are the vectors which can be represented as non-negative integral combination of the columns. The red dots can't. So you see the situation is more complicated as in the one-dimensional case. In the one-dimensional case, so m equals 1, you have the Frobenius number, and after that, everything is representable. Here in the two-dimensional case, in the higher dimensional case, it's much more complicated. But what you see, and this is the structure we are looking for, you can find copies of your cone. Yes, you can translate the cone to some point, and you can find then cones where all the points are reachable. And this is what we are looking for, and this, and we can give bounds for these points and so on. So we get similar results, but we don't get a nice lower bound. So we can generalize all the upper bounds for the Frobenius stuff. We can generalize also this the average Frobenius number, so to speak, to this general setting where we have matrices, but we don't have a good idea for a lower bound because now we cannot really control the combinatorial type of the polytopes which show up here. In the one-dimensional case, m equals 1, we always have simplices. They are quite boring, but because we can control, we can compute everything what we want. But here we have polytopes, and we don't know how to do that. One word to the proof of this inequality, how it works, say of the beginning of the first inequality, just the ideas. As I said, we use geometry of numbers, and this is the main lattice we are interested in, this lambda A. So you take the hyperplane. This is your input vector. You take the hyperplane. You look at all the lattice points living in this hyperplane. You normalize it by the Euclidean length to the power 1 over n minus 1. This gives you a lattice of determinant 1. And you study now a little bit this lattice. And bn minus 1 is the n minus 1 dimensional unit ball in the linear hull of this lattice, so in the hyperplane. And then we apply or use results of Cannon and recent results of Fukshansky and Robbins, which were independently proven by Arnold, in order to get a bound on the Frobenius number in terms, here you have already this number, the maximum norm to this power, and then you get this geometric quantity, which is an inhomogeneous minimum. The inhomogeneous minimum tells you how well you can cover your space, this is our hyperplane, by lattice translates of dilats of the unit ball. Okay. Whatever. This is the inhomogeneous minimum. The inhomogeneous minimum is a nice quantity, but it's hard to work with it. And so it is better to apply so-called Jarnik's inequalities, which transfer all the results to the so-called successive minima of Minkowski. So here, if you have a lattice, the ith successive minimum is just the minimum positive number such that the ball scaled by the factor lambda contains at least I linearly independent lattice points. Now you have this. Now you have a lattice of determinant 1. And we use this fact and inequalities of Minkowski in order to show that your quantity, which you want to bound, is somehow bounded by the ratio of two consecutive minima of your lattice to some power. And here you have a constant depending on n. And we do this because it is somehow intuitively clear if you take a random lattice. Now, this is a random n minus one dimensional lattice, so to speak, then the successive minima should be more or less the same. Okay. And this can be shown by some results. You can use some results of Wolfgang Schmidt on the distribution of so-called primitive sublattices that one can really show then this probability or that this right-hand side is small with high probability and you are done. Thank you for attention.